At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by David Lowry of the bands Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, important musical figure in my youth growing up. So, David, I'm glad to get you back on the show. We've had you on before. This is your return appearance. We'd love to see it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you reached out for this, right?
Yeah. So you have an album out today, Fathers, Sons, and Brothers. It's a solo album. It's out on CD, LP, streaming. You can get it in any preferred format.
I think you can even download it as well.
You can download the MP3s. It's a lost art.
I'll have to double check on that, but generally we use that as one of our releases. There are some people that prefer it still. Actually, there's a little segment of the music consuming audience that would like a uncompressed 192 KZ 24-bit file if you're willing to sell them.
Sure. So. That's the Neil Young model is mine. You know, isn't that his whole thing? Musical fidelity to the, it's really interesting. You sent me a copy of the CD. Thank you for that. So I could listen to it and we could discuss, the autobiographical nature of it. Again, this is a very interesting release strategy you have here. And I really want to get into that in a second, but it took me a second to figure out how to play the CD because I'm a physical media guy. I talk about this all the time. But my laptop does not have a CD drive in it anymore. I took the CD out to my car to listen to it in my car that I bought last year. And I realized for the first time that does not have a CD player anymore in it. Uh-huh. So I wound up listening to it on my Blu-ray player. Was how it worked for me. So just a weird sign of how things have changed.
That's funny because I had a couple people tell me that as well too, that they had to figure out how to play it. And for me, I have an old Newmark DJ turntable, you know, kind of professional grade sort of one that's in my sort of studio area. So I have to go in my studio area to listen to it because yes, both of my new vehicles do not have a CD player in them. And I love physical media as well too. I had another friend tell me he had to go play it in like his PlayStation or mm-hmm. one of the gaming yeah. consoles. Yeah. Because I turned out where the good speakers were too, though. So,
yeah, no. Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I put a CD in. God, what was it? I was trying to listen to the live Dire Straits double album that came back in the 1980s that I have on CD. I have on disc, but is not streaming anywhere. Alchemy, I think it is. And I got the CD out that I still have in my book of CDs, and I went to put it in my PlayStation 5. PlayStation 5 did not read it. It does not read CDs anymore. Yeah, I had to move it to the Blu-ray player, which was fascinating.
That's crazy.
But again, I'm sorry, I don't mean to get hung up on this, but it is a really interesting signifier of how the market has changed because I have bought more vinyl albums in recent years than CDs by far. I have a turntable. It mm-hmm. works fine, you know, but it, including I got the, I think I sent you a picture of this. I bought the 40th anniversary of the Camper Van Beethoven release. Right. It was out for Record Store Day this year. Very exciting. We could talk about that too, but all of this is preface. This first 4 minutes of ramble is preface for, from your perspective as a guy who has been in the industry for 40 plus years now. I mean, the first Camper Van Beethoven album came out in 83, I believe. Is that?
It actually came out in 85. We started 85. In 83. Yeah.
Okay.
We had a few little demo tapes in that underground punk rock way, you know, like mm-hmm. where you sold cassettes at shows. But the real first official release is 85.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. 40th anniversary. How has the industry changed from the perspective of somebody who sells music to people over the last 40 right. years?
Well, all the stuff that, you know, that the internet promised us about disintermediation and being able to sell directly to your fans, communicate directly to your fans, bypassing certain gatekeepers and stuff like that. All of that is largely true. Now, there's some caveats with that. There's also tyranny of choice. We have so much more to choose from that that's a new problem. That part is different, right? You know, we're not going necessarily to radio stations. We're not, you know, trying to get the local DJ to play us and stuff like that. But when we started in 1985 as an indie band, we didn't, aside from a few local college radio stations, there was nobody that was really going to play our record anyway. And there wasn't really... There were like fanzines, sort of local fanzines, but it was kind of hard to get, you know, like Rolling Stones or something like that to review a record. Mm-hmm. So all this, I'm sort of getting back to saying, it's more similar to how I started in the business, the very, very beginning. Those first couple years as a true indie artist where we were manufacturing our own vinyl albums and taking them to record stores and consigning them and, you know, just trying to get shows and selling things at shows and stuff like that. It's similar to that. So in some ways, it hasn't changed. Now, the mainstream of the music business, of course, is very, very different. But if you're approaching it from an indie artist, like the things I learned 40 years ago as kind of an indie artist are very useful today. You know, it's ultimately like when you're kind of an indie artist and you don't have the, you know, you're not going to get played on a, you know, pop country radio station or something like that. It's very word of mouth, very grassroots, very much getting the CD, the physical product into as many people's hands as possible. Even if they don't have a CD player, they've got it in their hands. It reminds them to stream it. Okay. It's just getting it in as many hands as possible. And just finding little sort of micro, I don't mean to call you a micro influencer and stuff like that, but literally like people on Twitter who tweet about music that I like and stuff like that. It's like, here's the album. What's your address? Here's the album, you know, like just talk about this, please. And so it's in a lot of ways, very, very similar. Now, of course, I mentioned the tyranny of choice. The other problem, though, is there's so much music out there now, and it is just really, really difficult to get somebody's attention. And so just putting out an album and putting it onto a streaming service where you're just going to appear as possibly some sort of recommendation based on what somebody listened to before is just... That's just not going to work. I mean, you got to do something different, right? You got to, I don't know, you have to do something else. So for me, what I'm doing with this record is, we'll talk about this in a minute, but it's ostensibly like a sort of an autobiographical record. And so what I'm doing with this album is I'm releasing it physical. I'm doing some shows, but I'm also doing Substacks for each song. And I'm about 17 songs into it right now, 17 out of 28. I hope I don't regret this because it was way more work than I thought it was going to be. Yeah. I hope to have all of these done before the record came out, but I'm releasing them every couple days. But yeah, so I'm doing a Substack as well, just to give sort of another, you know, sort of another media sort of segment to work in, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, no, I, and
that's very, very different, right? I wouldn't be, you know, that's very different. Like having to find all these other things to do, to go along with playing music. That's very different. That's very modern.
Yeah. Well, I look, obviously we're big believers in Substack here at the Bulwark. It's been a huge, boon for us in terms of not just reaching new audiences, but, you know, generating revenue and all that sort of stuff. Is it similar to the world of zines back in the 1980s? I mean, is this just like a totally different experience?
Man, it's more like MySpace.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like, that's what I think of. I think actually MySpace was one of the great underrated music innovations like that happened, that changed how we consume music. And then, of course, it got blown away and it's gone. But it changed a lot about music. So in a way, it is kind of like fanzines. But like doing a Substack, it's kind of like fanzines, you're writing it yourself. That's the weird thing about doing a lot of interviews and podcasts in these days. Not for you. You guys have a built-in audience and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the music podcasts rely on essentially the artist bringing their audience there.
Right.
And then hopefully those people stick around and look at some of the other, you know, podcast interviews that have happened. Right. It's not necessarily like a fanzine where, you know, a fanzine is like you have a little following in your local area and stuff like that. People read your fanzine when it comes out every week and you're going to introduce that. I mean, there's some of that, but it's different, you know. I mean, we're carrying more of the audience sort of with us, and we have to create more content and stuff like that, which is, we're already recording albums. It's a lot of work, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, I imagine it's interesting because the, one big difference I assume for you now, as opposed to 40 years ago, is that you do have that built-in audience. You do have a kind of base of people who are, who have been fans for a long time. I mean, you have the camper van Beethoven, you know, camp out events. Like there's you guys have all sorts of stuff going on, which I assume translates somewhat to the solo releases like this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of works together. I mean, we had a debate about this, so I think. Maybe I should explain what you're getting at. We had a Cracker retrospective come out in December or in early December. And we kind of marketed that really heavily. And then we had a Camper Van Beethoven Record Store Day 40th anniversary release. And then I put out this solo album. And so all of that happened in a period of 6 months. Like in the old music business, you would never do that.
Right.
You got to go away for a while. You got to create space and stuff like that. But in this environment, the conclusion, and we do this through, this is all done through Cooking Vinyl, which is a large British indie record label, been around for a long time. We discussed it, you know, do we want to do it the old way or we want to do it this new way where we just generate a bunch of energy and a bunch of different projects all going at once. And hopefully they're interconnected and it helps market the record. And that's the way we chose to do it. Just kind of put it all out on top of each other, you know, very quickly on top of each other to generate just more marketing. I don't know, you know, whatever you call marketing these days, more energy or something like that. So that's very different from how we would have done it in the old days. Yeah. Very different.
Yeah. A real multiplier effect of, you know, the buzz on top of buzz.
Exactly.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Father, Sons, and Brothers, because again, it's a very interesting project. In the liner notes of the CD, you know, you said people have told you to write an autobiography. And I think there would be, I think you're underselling.
I'm doing it anyway, apparently. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the Substack actually sounds like you've taken all that on extra. Anyway, no, but I think you have a more interesting story than I think you give yourself credit for in terms of not just the music industry, but also your work at UGA and in the field of music technology and streaming and all that more broadly, but the album itself is an autobiographical effort. What about your story did you want to convey to people? What about your life did you want to convey to listeners?
Yeah. So I think what I did was honestly wanted to just sort of thank people in my life and sort of like, hey, here's this great supporting cast of characters, whether it's my parents, whether it's my cousins or my, we'll get at that second, you know, my family, my sisters and stuff like that, or David McDaniel, who I started Camper Van Beethoven with, but left the band after 3 months. He has an interesting story there. Mm-hmm. And I sort of want to be like, hey, let's look at all the cast and character here, with also the notion that there's also a lot of things that happened when I tell those stories that shape who I am, sort of shape how I play music, my approach to music and stuff like that. Like, it sort of never occurred to me that, like, I play guitar a little differently than most Americans play because I have some of the Spanish influence from having lived in Spain for 5 years, growing up in Spain. You know, there's just like weird little things like that. And there's one song I do on the record it's Everybody Get a Effing Day Job. It's a pretty useful word. It's done like a Sevillana. Spanish style guitar playing. My wife plays castanets and claps really fast on it. And, you know, so there's things in my background. So I tell a story about living in Spain in one of the songs, in the second song, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, it's just sort of like, that was kind of weird. I grew up in Spain and Franco was a dictator, right? You know, there were like, the crazy stuff happened, you know, and stuff like that. But also it's like, well, that's sort of where some of the little sort of Spanish influence comes into some of my music and stuff like that. So even though I'm telling sort of the background and cast and characters, supporting members and stuff like that, it's also still telling my story. And it was a less narcissistic way of sort of telling my story, I hope. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting too. I, again, as I was kind of reading the notes and listening to the songs, I learned that you're an Air Force brat. Your dad was Air Force. This is a congruence in my own life. My dad flew C-130s for 20 years. We moved kind of all around the world, and it is that perspective absolutely. Shapes how you see and perceive and explain the world, I think, in a way that's hard sometimes to convey to people.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a little bit of this of sort of like, you didn't really grow up anywhere, you know? I mean, I was born in Texas, Arkansas, England, Spain, Southern California. We stuck in Southern California for a long time. Mm-hmm. And my parents retired there and stuff like that. And then I went to Northern California. But I was very comfortable with moving around. So I moved to Virginia. Then I moved to Georgia. You know, it was like very comfortable moving around. And then also the other thing about it is you sort of start thinking of yourself sort of as a Pan-American or an omni-American. I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. you're just like, well, who am I really? You know, I'm not really a Southerner. I'm not really a Californian and stuff like that, you know? So I sort of have this, I'm a meta, I don't know. You're sort of just sort of a not being from anywhere, but yet being American, but having lived in all over the kind of a lot of different places in the world and stuff like that, that's, very different than, say, if you were like my wife. She grew up in Atlanta, you know, and then moved 55 miles away to Athens, Georgia. Like, mm-hmm. she's a Georgian. I'm not a Georgian. Mm-hmm. I'm not really a Californian. I'm not like really, you know, it's different. It's a different experience, you know.
Well, and living in England and Spain will drive home that sense of Americanness as well, because there is you are I don't know about your experience. I mean, when I lived in England, we lived off base. We lived in like a British town, and it was very much like you're the American, and it was different.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely the case. My mother is English, though, so. You know, in some ways we were sort of halfway mm-hmm. English and halfway American. But yeah, I mean, you just get used to things like you're in a pub and they're like, what does the Yank want? You know, mm-hmm. You know, you're just constantly referred to as the Yank or something like that. Spain was interesting, though, because, like I said, that was under Franco. My mom wasn't very happy about that because she lived through World War II, and she saw, you know, Franco was just, to her, was Hitler adjacent. But she also loved Spain. But in Spain, we lived also not on the base. Right. And you didn't always do that when you lived in Spain. But our little my dad was actually attached to the Spanish Air Force. Mm-hmm. Like there was like 100 Air Force, U.S. Air Force people that were attached to the Spanish Air Force. So we lived in the suburbs of Sevilla. Right. And just with everybody. I mean, it was there was an American enclave in this neighborhood, but there wasn't a fence around it or anything like that. And it just connected to all the other neighborhoods, you know, and stuff like that. So people just walk through our neighborhood and stuff like that. But yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's fascinating. So you guys, you end up settling in California, which is, you know, where your music career starts, but there are also, you know, some of the songs, particularly in the early, the first half or so of the first disc are really into, how to put it? Hell raising as a youth. Yeah. There's some hell raising, which again is kind of interesting. I'm curious how you navigated that with, again, career military parents and also, you know, punk rock slacker friends in California. Like, those are two very different worlds kind of colliding.
Yeah. So, my dad was like he was the first mass. He was kind of like chief, like at the base. So he was kind of the disciplinarian, you know, sort mm-hmm. of or something like that on the base, in a way. But he was like the sweetest dude to us, right? He was like a really sweet, sensitive guy to the family, and so I'm sure he probably didn't appreciate our hell raising. But, like, he sort of approached it with kind of like, well, boys are going to be boys. And, you know, you really can't do this. If something happened to you, imagine what that would do to your mother. You know, like that kind of approach mm-hmm. and stuff like mm-hmm. that. It wasn't like this hard disciplinarian. So, you know, and then you'd be like, oh, I feel like an idiot. It worked really well. Be like, oh, I feel like an idiot now. You know, now I really need to get on the straight and narrow and, you know, not do these things and, you know, what my friends are doing and stuff like that, you know. But yeah, it was pretty wild. Southern California in the 70s was really wild too.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing about it was, I mean, we were just in the environment. And then, you know, a lot of there's one song about my cousins who are, they are beyond hellraisers. I mean, they mm-hmm. they steal a car and then set it on fire. And that's a little beyond hellraising. So that's another level of it or something like that. Then there was, you know, that my cousins on my dad's side, there were some wild kids in that bunch. And, you know, so, but not. But I also, like, they were so good to me. They were so nice to me. And they were like my big brothers, you know. I didn't have a big brother. I had all sisters and stuff like that, you know. And so those songs are super confusing just to even write, you know, because you're like, well, they're going to do this bad thing. Then they're going to do this bad thing. But look how nice they are to me, you know. I explain this more in the Substack, you know, like how protective they were of me and stuff, right, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about that. Do you find that the Substack essays accompanying the songs help you work through, you know, what the songs themselves, what you're trying to say in the songs themselves, or are these intended more just for the audience? I guess my question is the Substack helping you work through your own ideas of the songs, or is it more of a kind of annotated guide to helping everybody else?
Well, I started it as an annotated guide, but sort of there's some self-discovery that's sort of happened. Self-discovery. I never talk like that.
No, it's good.
But something like that is happening because I realized so there's a song called Piney Woods that's about a lot of my Arkansas family moved back to Arkansas. And when I move across country, I stop and just kind of visit them and hang out with them, just hang out with my grandmother. But also that song is really about the tragedy at the center of my dad's family, which is the murder-suicide of his brother. That happened kind of on the family farm in front of everybody. And, you know, this is this completely obviously was a horrible event and changed everybody's lives. But as I was sort of writing this blog, I suddenly realized it's like, well, wait a minute, this not only, you know, I knew my dad suffered, you know, sort of from some sort of anxiety, some sort of PTSD or something, a mild version of that from that occurring. I knew my grandfather was really affected by it. My grandmother, being very deeply religious, seemed to have handled it the best. It also, I realized, oh, wait a minute. That's why they sold their place in Arkansas and just basically became like itinerant farm workers and went to California, right? That's why my dad joined the Air Force. That's why... You know, like it sort of, there were a lot of things in my life that were sort of explained as I sort of, you know, I started looking up records, death certificates, like all these different things. Like, where did people move? Where were people living? And as I was doing that song, I was like, oh, this really explains a lot about like what happened. Why my family, like, for instance, went to California, you know, like why my dad's family went to California, you know. Anyway, so there is some of that in there. Yeah, it started as an annotated guide, but I'm sort of getting something out of doing it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've only read I think only the first chapter is
yeah,
available right
I've
now.
Only You're made just... it available. I should have yeah. shown you.
No, It's fine. I like this idea of kind of. Are you going to roll them out a week at a time? You're not going to put all 17 out at once. You can't do that. That's bad.
Yeah,
you got to drip it out.
HBO or is it Netflix?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So no, it's. I'm putting them out. I put out I think the first 3 or 4 days I put them one out every day, but then after that it goes to twice a week.
Okay.
Is what I have planned. So that's what I'm doing. Yeah.
Yeah,
and so it rolls through. I think August is sort of what the schedule does. So I have time to finish the other. How many do I need? I need 11 more. So,
yeah, it's a lot of writing. I mean, that is just on top of everything else you do. That is simply
a couple of them were really short because I was like, the song sort of explains everything, so it's like. A paragraph, basically, a couple of them, but most of them are 2,000 to 3,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. And I think there's one that's even longer than that. So, I mean, it's a lot of writing. Yes.
Yeah. There's one of the one of the songs on this album. I wrote a song called "Take the Skinheads Bowling," which of course is a reference to kind of the I wasn't around in 1985, so I can't say this for, but I think the best known song off your first album.
Take the Skinheads Bowling. This is kind of the song that made Cameron Van Beethoven famous, and weirdly gets played immediately on the BBC. Indie band sends a record to the BBC and they play it. It's like crazy.
it's super interesting because the song on the new album is also regret is the wrong word, but tinged with a sort of the song is about the song, but it's also about your founding co-member of the band who went on to establish a church and do good.
Went on mission work. Yeah. So it's about it becomes sort of a. It's like, hey, here's somebody behind the scenes. I want to tell you about him because you never heard of him, and in some ways. He probably lived a better life than I did, you know, or sort of a more noble life than I did. And you never heard of him. He started the band. And it was literally the story in the song is that we were in the band. He was in the band with me, and it was me, him, and Chris Mola. This were the founding members of Camper, maybe Victor Krumenacher, you count him as well, came in shortly after that. But he gave the band the name and was a lot of the energy and wrote songs like, Blassie Goes to the Moon, some of these quirky songs that people really, really love. But he was only in the band for 3 months because we decided we'd move to Santa Cruz. And we wanted him to move there with us. We were in Southern California. We wanted him to move there with us. And I talked to him about it. He goes, well, I've been wanting to talk to you anyway, because like I feel like I have a calling from God to go and become a minister and go and, be a missionary. It's like sort of didn't really see that coming, but I mean, it made sense to in a certain way because he was fairly devout, religious and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, that's cool, man. And, and he went on and did that and we went on to being in a band. But I think what you're picking up on is that I had a conversation once. You do a podcast with Rob Long, don't you?
I have been on a podcast with Rob Long. I'm not part of the GLOP universe.
Okay, I couldn't remember. But I met him for coffee one time and did that follow his martini shot and stuff. We started talking about the music business, and I was specifically saying all the music business movies are pretty much all bad because they don't get that there's no redeeming characters in the music business, including the artists like me, because you end up being so self-absorbed. And sort of there's a narcissistic bent to everything that you have to do. It's like literally like required of you. It's like the job. And so in some ways you do go down to the crossroads and sell your soul to the devil, right? Mm-hmm. There's no redeeming character. Any movie about the music business that has any redeeming characters in it is bullshit for that reason, right? So there's part of what that song is me like going, yeah, I went around the world playing Take the Skinheads Bowling for girls that like the song Take the Skinheads Bowling or something like that, sort of alluding to that and contrasting that with what David McDaniel did with his life, right?
Yeah.
So that's you picked up exactly at what I'm getting at on here. So
yeah. No, it's it is interesting. I'm stuck thinking on the question: are there any movies about the music business that have no redeeming characters? The closest I can think is: did you ever see Rockstar?
I think has no redeeming. That's no redeeming characters in it. So
Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap. but it's as a parody, but it's not. So, right.
That's funny. God. The sequel to Spinal Tap coming out soon, believe it or not. What was the one I was singing? There's the Mark Wahlberg movie Rockstar. Did you see that, like, 2000? It comes out, and it's about a guy who is like a cover singer for some, Aerosmith-esque band, and their lead singer quits, and he comes in. But it really is all about, like, how terrible everybody in that whole world is. It's kind of fascinating.
I think you're the second person to tell me that I should watch that movie for that reason after I made that comment. So I think I will go and watch it. Because I'm like,
it's not a great movie. I would not describe it as a great movie, but it does kind of hit that theme of the general decrepitude of the music industry.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, but we love it too because it provides the soundtrack to our lives. But
totally.
Yeah, I mean, there is this thing about it that, you know, there are no redeeming characters in it. Redeemable characters.
Yeah. Well, I want to, speaking of the music industry, there was a little bit more I wanted to discuss. You mentioned the tyranny of choice earlier, and the being kind of at the whims of the algorithm and, you know, Spotify and all that. And you have kind of famously sued Spotify for not paying royalties at the proper rate, and that's all very interesting, and, you know, I think good, like capital G good. I think it's artists are, you know, getting taken advantage of, shall we say. But also this is how people listen to music in large swaths of the country. Like, this is just how people listen to music. They turn on Spotify and, like, whatever comes up. I am curious to get your take on how that affects the emergence of new music and new bands, and B, really what it means for you as an artist with a back catalog. I mean, Cracker had some big hits, Low and Teen Angst, and like there are songs in your catalog that I'm sure kind of outperform everything else put together. How does that from your perspective, again, as somebody who's been in the industry 40 years, when you look at Spotify and you think, like, okay, how does somebody get into the business now? How do they do it?
Yeah, so a lot of the younger artists, and you know, I teach music business at Terry College of Business at University of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my students are actually, I'm in the business school, so there's a lot of business students, but a lot of kids are aspiring artists who want to become popular. And a number of them have come out over the years and at least got a few million streams and stuff like that, with a couple of them getting bigger. But in the last few years, in the last 4 years or something like that, it's all from getting something going viral on TikTok, which is very good for amplifying a certain kind of song with a certain kind of hook. It's kind of the more pop stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And whether it's country or whether it's indie or whether it's straight up pop or hip hop or whatever like that. So there's a very clear path for that kind of music. Everything else, though, is just completely the Wild West, right? Mm-hmm. One of the bands, not my students, but from here at, were UGA students and were in our townies and stuff like that, is sort of the Americana sort of country jam psychedelic group Future Birds, right? Mm-hmm. And I just don't, I look at their career and I'm like, I don't know how they really became famous. You know, they just sort of kept playing shows. They kept putting out albums. They sort of organized a little festival sort of thing. But it took like 10 years, but it seems to have sort of blossomed into something pretty big, mm-hmm. right? And I bet you if you ask them, like, how did that happen? They would be like, I don't really know. We just kind of kept doing it, you know, and we got a little bigger and bigger we started in an area and that area got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it's a lot of just going out, playing live or doing in real life events, for those type of bands or for building, there is one path. It's sort of the Jimmy Buffett path, I sort of call it. Like Roger Klein and the Peacemakers out of Arizona. I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with them, but they were Refreshments, and then they became yeah. Roger Klein and the Peacemakers. So they're people that are like almost my age, right? There's a path that looks like that for some of these young bands, where they essentially develop a bunch of other. They do go sort of the Disney route. They develop a bunch of other IP around their original IP. So, you know, Roger Klein's got like a tequila, a couple festivals, weird events, sure. Like let's do sort of Arizona highways, you know, and go to all these different towns and drag people along with us, or, you know, let's do a walk in the desert, you know? It's branding with all this other stuff in it. So I'm not thinking of a good example of a young band doing that, but it's almost like sort of the Disney route of like, well, we started out putting out records, but then we developed all this other IP around it and all these other sources of revenue and stuff like that. And then eventually it all fed back into the albums. So we don't do what we do best in a way. We have to branch out into all this other stuff to support what we do best, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's
interesting because the way you describe that, what comes to mind for me, again, as a more of a movie business guy, as a movie business kind of observer, is you see this with guys like Ryan Reynolds, right? Ryan Reynolds, who has his own gin, and he does the mobile phone ads, and he has the Wrexham AFC show. And like all of that, you know, kind of is all of that is bolstered by his movie stardom, but also like feeds back into it, makes him kind of an omnipresence and a brand unto himself, which is interesting. It's a different route to movie stardom than I think we have seen before. But
yeah,
effective.
And that, I think that's exactly what we're. I think that's what I'm talking about. So for instance, when I do sort of like, okay, somebody really wants me to give them advice, which I don't know if I'm great for giving advice, you know, a student or something like that. I do tell them this. I go, it looks like the people that are really being successful and actually making money now are going beyond the recordings, you know. And it could be just, you know, it's your recording and your live shows, but you got to turn your live shows into some sort of an event, a destination. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you got to do meetups when you're not playing, you know, you got to go to the record stores, you got to go to the, you know, so that's what I'm saying is you got to sort of build up all this other stuff around what you're doing with your music, because that's where you get paid the least now. Yeah. And live shows can pay well, but you got to really push, you know, you got to start, you got to have your shows in the right size venue. I mean, you don't have to be the biggest artist in the world, but you need to be selling, you know, if you're getting 1,000 people a night, you need to be selling out, you know, the 9:30 club and not playing in a place that's too big. There's all kinds of tricky stuff like that, that you have to figure out.
Right? Yeah. I think I saw that you're going to be at the 9:30 club, not too long from now.
Yeah, Camper Van Beethoven's going to do one of our 40th anniversary of the first album shows at the 9:30 Club, September 20th. Yes.
September 20th. Yeah. Big, I am an enormous fan of the 9:30 Club, having lived in D.C. for a long time. Best venue in the city. And have am like, I don't, I don't, you have no reason to know the ins and outs of the DC music, live music business, but I've been a little bit sad to see the Anthem kind of overtake it as the go-to spot for bands of a certain size. The 930 Club remains just the absolute mm-hmm. best place to see music.
Yeah. Yeah. There's actually DC's okay. So DC is a great live music market. I think you have a lot of people without kids who can have money who can afford to go mm-hmm. to see shows or something like that. There's a certain thing there. So it's a great, so of course with that opportunity there to make money from shows, a lot of people have open venues, but it's actually been very good for DC in a way that there's the Anthem now competing with the 930 Club. And there's also yeah. the Hamilton for the sit down kind yeah, of yeah. show is well done. So
yeah, the Hamilton's a really nice venue for exactly that sort of thing. Like, it probably skews a little older, like more relaxed mm-hmm. Type show. It's a nice venue with pretty good acoustics. And
yeah, it's like if you're going to do a sort of a singer songwriter listening room type thing, it's not exclusively that, but it works for that. Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of probably an upside for the fans in DC, but yes, we are old school 930 venue artists. I mean, Camper Van Beethoven played at the 930 Club in like March of 1986 when it was at wow. 930 F Street yeah. or whatever, when it held 250 people and was famous for having the rats in the backstage. Yeah. So, you know, that's a great venue for us. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Let's see. My one last question was, hey, look, so I'm pretty upfront with people about this. I'm not a music guy. Like I'm not, that is not, it is not my area of expertise. I am the movie guy. I will say that I have recently in the last year or so here, started trying to get back more into music. I find myself listening to XMU a lot on Sirius XM. And mm-hmm. that is how I find most of the new bands that I enjoy and like listening to. Have introduced a couple even to my younger daughter. She's 9. We're going to see Beach Bunny next week. That should be fun. But the is that just totally niche? Is that just a total niche market? Is that or is that an actual avenue of discovery for larger audiences?
XMU and
well
Sirius
XMU, but also just terrestrial radio and satellite radio in general. Like is radio still a venue of discovery for people?
Yes, it is. But the playlists are so tight. Really, the only discovery is around the margins. So, for instance, mm-hmm. it's still like if you touch upon the Americana world. You know, if your stuff is slightly country rock, what much of my stuff is and stuff like that, there's kind of a panel of these often public owned radio stations around the country that play that format or play a kind of indie that leans towards Americana format. There's a number and then yes, Sirius XM has certain shows like we get played probably on XMU, but we probably also get played on their Outlaw Country channel, mm-hmm. which is sort of not, you know, commercial country. It's this other country.
Right.
Those work. Those are important. I'm hoping that those radio stations will play my new album and expose us to people. But it's weird because a lot of it, though, is also online. Like people that listen to WXPN out of Philly listen to it online mm-hmm. or WFMU out of New Jersey. People listen to that online. Like I'm in Athens, Georgia, and people are walking around with WFMU T-shirts for the college mm-hmm. as a college radio station for, I don't even remember what university it is in New Jersey. There's also one out of KEXP out of Seattle that people listen to. So those still do, but there, I don't think it's my college students listening to that. I think they're following playlists or they're It's weird. It's like my college students are either listening to like classic rock albums from the early 70s or a TikTok artist, you know, right? It's mm-hmm. like it's bizarre how they find music. So I think it is still
That is interesting.
There is part of radio that's still important, but it's grown-ups, right? It's people who have a car with Sirius XM in it, or they have a desk job where they can play a stream of, you know, WXPN, you know, quietly on the speakers in their office, you know, or something like that while they're sorting spreadsheets or something. I don't know, you know, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, when I got this new car a year or so ago, I was like, all right, fine, I'll do the, you know, the XM trial for 2 years. Mm-hmm. It was super cheap and it's been great. It's been, mm-hmm. it's really been good for me, but also like I am a very weird type of music enjoyer. I don't have Spotify. I don't have, Apple Music. I think we have Amazon Music. Mostly my daughter listens to Taylor Swift on it. That's the extent of
Amazon tends to be families listening to it. I sort of know the breakdown of these demographics on each one of these. My audience is more on Apple.
Oh, interesting. What's the difference? What's the difference between the Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Spotify consumers?
I think Apple is age-wise is just sort of matches more of sort of a heavy Gen X and older millennial, because they started with the phone, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's how they. Spotify came out a couple of years before Apple Music, but it's just so easy if you're in the Apple world to just play something in the music, right? Which gives some argument to the antitrust case, but I think that's what it is. If you're Spotify tends to be younger, like I said, Amazon seems to be more casual, tends to be more family subscriptions. People like, hey, play this song for me. But give me a Christmas playlist, you know. Those are the type of things that you see with Amazon. I mean, somebody from a record company could totally break this down for me, because they'll go into like the Hispanic, you know, where is rap listened to, which I understand YouTube is super important for rap. Mm-hmm. And it's also the worst paying of all the platforms. So, you know, people can get into that. But I do know that Apple Music is basically the important one for us, followed by Spotify for our demo. Yeah. Now, if we want to reach younger people, we need to make sure we're doing that our record label is doing its thing on Spotify. So, you know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. And of course, Father, Sons, and Brothers is available on all the major streaming services. You can go save it now, listen to it.
You could save it now, listen to it. And we did put it up. Yeah, because normally in the past when we've sold physical products, we usually send a download code with that so you can get a high fidelity download. But we didn't do that this time because it's available on streaming services on the other platforms. Mm-hmm. So, yes. So you can do that. If you just realized you don't have a CD player.
My car doesn't have
a CD player in it?
I swear to God, I took my CD out there and was like, oh, wait, I actually can't listen to it this way. It was a rude awakening again. And again, as I was mildly embarrassed because I am a physical media evangelist, to realize that I had shifted so thoroughly to streaming and vinyl.
Yeah, I should have sent you vinyl, but it's also our vinyl box set is super expensive. It's three albums and it's colored vinyl and big booklet. But
it's a nice looking set. I'll put it on my birthday or Christmas list. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see if Santa comes through. Let's see what else. You know, that was everything. That was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's anything folks should know about the album, about your Substack, about the music business at large. What do you think folks should know that we failed to discuss today?
Well, the album is, it says solo, and it is, a lot of the songs are just me with an acoustic guitar, but I use I use about 20 different people on the record. And sometimes it is with my band Cracker, the rhythm section from my band Cracker backing me up. Mm-hmm. So some of the songs are actually, you know, full on rock extravaganzas, you know, with a string section and, you know, guitar, two keyboards, bass and drums and backing vocalists. So don't think it's just all singer songwriter, you know, with the acoustic guitar stuff. It's not all that.
Yeah, it's a proper proper rock, country rock, you know, kind of indie rock album. And I will say the one note that I did, again, I'm not a music critic. This is not my job. But one note that I did jot down was that I really enjoyed the fiddle work by Luke Moeller.
Luke Moeller, yeah. So there's two standout stars is Megan Slankard, who's backing vocalist, keyboard player, who does some really cool 10cc style 70s arrangements on stuff. And then Luke Moeller, who is from Australia, but is kind of a Nashville real country fiddle player, and he's outstanding on this stuff. Yeah. So I ended up leaning into those two a lot, as well as the bass player and drummer from Cracker play on a lot of the songs as well. So yeah.
It's a great sounding album. If you're into you recorded this mostly, or you at least I think it said in the notebook, the liner notes, that you started recording this during the pandemic. Is that right?
Well, I started before that, but then as the pandemic happened, it's a very real sort of what we call in the business a laptop album, mm-hmm. in that nobody is really in the same room at the same time. We're having, like, I was to do the fiddle, I'm emailing files to Luke in Australia at 8 at night, and he's getting up, recording it overnight. Then when I wake up in the morning, he has files for me, yeah. Right? So it's one of those kind of records. We had to do that way in COVID, but then it also, like, you know, Megan Slankard lives in San Francisco. I'm not going out to San Francisco to re-record the backing vocals. I'm not flying here to record the backing vocals. I just send it to her and she does it in her own studio. So it became one of those kind of records, because COVID sort of forced it to, but then that became the vibe of the record. It's a very modern way of recording records. It's the way a lot of records are made nowadays. But I didn't normally do that, so this is kind of new for me.
Oh, that's so. I just look at all this through my own lens of recording podcasts, where we're all atomized and separate, and, you know, we're talking to each other now, but, you know, that's not always.
Yeah.
How it works. Sometimes you got to splice things in. That's obviously a very different vibe. Does it change how you write or arrange the music?
Yeah. Cause a lot of times what you can do with, like if you're more in like a band, you know, and you've got a decent budget, you'll go into a studio basically with your songs sort of just half-assed out, like sort of sketched mm-hmm. out. And you'll go and then get together with everybody, and you might have like a sort of a pre-recording session where you demo it and you just kind of go to a cheap studio and then you flesh it out. And then you go into the studio where it's a little more fleshed out. And so it's a lot more collaborative, and Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker are much more collaborative. The way we make albums and stuff like that, and almost everybody's in the same room at the same time doing things, has a different sound. But then the modern way of doing it is, you know, all these kids kind of grew up like, hey, I have this Apple GarageBand program on my laptop, and I bought a couple microphones and this little mic preamp, and I just learned to record, and I send it to my friends and they record their things. And so that's the very modern way of doing it. and it changed the sound of music. That's the way hip hop's done too, you know? So there's good and bad things. I mean, there's good things about this as well too, but this is sort of the first time I've really done a record like in the more modern way where it is a laptop record.
Yeah. And it has to be much cheaper if everybody's recording at home in their own, you know, if everybody's recording in a room like this and sending you the files, you don't have to, you know, block out hours and days and weeks at a studio.
Well, it is cheaper, but here's one day I need to go on an economics podcast and talk about this phenomena. It's cheaper in the sense of about the amount of money that you're laying out to make the record, but in your own costs, like your own time, what you end up doing is you're able to just work endlessly refining things. And so in some ways, what a lot of people discovered when we sort of went into the laptop records is like, you spend a lot more time on the records with your own the amount of time that you personally put into it, because the possibilities for tweaking are endless. And you sort of end up doing that, whether you end up, you know, like half the time you'll tweak and tweak and tweak, and then you go back to what you originally had and you're like, what was I thinking? This is way better, right? But that's what happens, you know, and you know, so it is cheaper, but I think you spend more time on it. So in a way, it's like, it just means it's cheaper in the sense that you're paying other people less. And the true way to do a laptop record is you always have an engineer, a professional engineer involved in it. Like, you send them the files after you're doing something at home and you're like, does this sound right? And they're like, let me come over and change some things for you, right? And, you know, you pay them their $250 or whatever like that for spending an afternoon with you getting it sounding right, and then you're recording it again. You almost always do have you basically have your professional cinematographer, you know, involved in this, even though – and they mix it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then you have a real mastering engineer master it.
Yeah.
So –
So it's not like,
sorry,
so it's
to go
not like
off
me. I'm just going
to
slap all these together in audition. All these, your audio file and my audio file and the intro and outro music, and it's gone. It's not quite that simple, huh?
Yeah. Well, some people do it completely themselves, but yeah, like if at our level, yeah, you hire a professional engineer to be sort of oversee the project and to mix it.
Well, it sounds great on my soundbar that my Blu-ray player is connected to. So I'll say
great.
That. Well, I'll let you know how it sounds on my headphones whenever it hits streaming here. I'll make sure to get a little closer to it. But we'll see. David, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on, and I appreciate it.
And again, the name of the album is Father, Son, and what's that?
I love the podcast. I listen into it every week.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
That's true.
I know you do, because you actually recommended it. I just saw randomly that you recommended it to someone. I was like, oh, that's nice. But no, thank you. That is very kind. And again, the name of the album is Fathers, Sons, and Brothers. And your Substack, I'll link to the Substack in the post that goes up with this, but just for folks, it's davidlowry.substack.
It's David C. Lowry.
David C. Lowry. Substack.
And technically, according to SAG-AFTRA, I have to be David C. Lowry. So
yes.
Okay.
Well, there's a director, David Lowry.
I know, and everybody. There was a period of time where every once in a while, accidentally, I would get an email because there was a small overlap with music supervisors. I'd be like, reading an email and go, this isn't for me. Right.
So, yeah, no, that's, I have to get the other David Lowry on. Maybe we can get his, All right. Thank you again. Thank you for being on the show. This is great. The album's name, Father, Sons, and Brothers, davidclowry.substack.com. Check him out. I think you'll enjoy it. I certainly have enjoyed listening to it and reading the post so far. So it's a success from my point of view.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10/1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.